Emmeline Pethick Lawrence, one of Mrs. Shawcross's heroines, was a member. Mrs. Shawcross had been a suffragette.
"Very brave," Major Shawcross said fondly.
"One still learned woodcraft," Mrs. Shawcross explained, "when camping and hiking and so on, but it was underpinned by an emphasis on the spiritual regeneration of England's youth." This appealed to Sylvie, if not to Teddy. Although she was generally hostile to any idea that had Mrs. Shawcross as its origin, Sylvie nonetheless decided it would be a good thing for Teddy.
"Anything that doesn't encourage war," she said.
Teddy hardly thought that the Scouts encouraged war, but his protests were in vain. It was not just the sewing Mrs. Shawcross had failed to mention. There was also the dancing, the folk singing, the prancing around in the woods, and the endless talking. They were in clans and tribes and lodges, for there were a good deal of supposed Red Indian customs mixed up with the supposed Saxon ritual, making an unlikely hodgepodge.
"Perhaps Mrs. Shawcross has found one of the lost tribes of Israel," Pamela laughed.
They all chose Indian names for themselves. Teddy was Little Fox.
"Naturally," Ursula said.
Nancy was Little Wolf.
"Honiahaka, in Cheyenne," Mrs. Shawcross said.
She had a book she referred to. Mrs. Shawcross herself was Great White Eagle.
"Oh, for heaven's sake," Sylvie said. "Talk about hubris."
There were some good things, being with Nancy, for one, and they learned archery with real bows and arrows, not things that they had to make themselves from branches or such like. Teddy liked archery, which he thought might come in useful one day, if he became an outlaw, for example. Would he have the heart to shoot a deer? Rabbits, badgers, foxes, even squirrels occupied a tender place in that heart. He supposed if it were a matter of survival, if starvation were the only option. He would draw the line somewhere, though. Dogs. Larks.
"It all sounds rather pagan," Hugh said doubtfully to Mrs. Shawcross.
"Roberta, please."
This was in an earlier conversation, before their incident in the conservatory, before he had thought of her as a woman.
"Well, utopian might be a better description," she said.
"Ah, utopia," Hugh said wearily. "What an unhelpful idea that is."
"Isn't it wild," Mrs. Shawcross said, "who writes that progress is the realization of utopias?"
"I would hardly look to that man for my moral creed," Hugh said,
rather disappointed in Mrs. Shawcross, a deterrent he would remind himself of later, when his thoughts returned to the scent of geraniums and the lack of corsetry. Teddy's idea of utopia would not have included the Kibbo Kift. What would it have included? A dog, certainly. Preferably more than one. Nancy and his sisters would be there. His mother, too, he supposed. And they would all live in a lovely house set in the green countryside of the home counties, and eat cake every day. His real life, in fact. In turn, the Kibbo Kift produced their own breakaway movement, the less eccentric woodcraft folk, by which time Teddy had managed to weasel his way out of the lot of them. At school, he joined the OTC, and enjoyed the concerted lack of pacifism. He was a boy, after all. He would have been surprised to know that in his 60s, when his grandchildren came to live with him in York, he would spend several months trailing backwards and forwards to a chilly church hall, so that Bertie and Sonny could attend a weekly meeting of the woodcraft folk group that they were members of. Teddy thought that continuity would probably be a good thing for them, seeing as Viola, their mother, seemed to have provided so little. He gazed at his grandchildren's innocent faces while they intoned the hopeful words of the creed at the beginning of the meeting. "We shall go singing to the fashioning of a new world." He even went on a camping trip with them, and was complimented on his woodcraft skills by the group leader, who, despite being large, young, and black, reminded him a little of Mrs. Shawcross.
"Learned in the Scouts," he said.
Even all those years later, unwilling to admit that he had taken anything from the Kibbo Kift. Sylvie paid the cab driver, and the hotel doorman opened the door of the cab and murmured, "Madam." She hesitated on the pavement. Another doorman was already holding open the door of the hotel. "Madam?" Again. She moved closer, inch by slow inch, edging her way towards adultery. "Madam?" the doorman said again, still holding the door, perplexed by this slow progress. The hotel beckoned. She could see the lush tones of the foyer, the promise of luxury. Imagine champagne sparkling in engraved bohemian glass, foie gras, pheasant. The dimmed lighting in the room, the bed with its starched hotel sheets. Her cheeks flamed. He will be waiting inside, just beyond the door. Perhaps he had glimpsed her, was already rising to his feet to greet her. She hesitated again, balancing what she was about to be given against what she was about to give away. Or, perhaps a worse outcome, everything would simply remain the same. And then she thought of her children, thought of Teddy, her best boy. Would she risk her life as his mother, for an adventure? A cold thrill of horror quenched the flames of sin. For sin it was, she thought, make no mistake. You did not need a god. Sylvie was an unconfessed atheist, to believe in sin. She composed herself, difficult, and said to the doorman, rather haughtily,
"Oh, I'm so sorry. I've just remembered another appointment, elsewhere."
She fled, walking quickly, head held high, a purposeful woman with a decent, civilized destination beckoning her, a charitable committee, even a political meeting. Anything but a rendezvous with a lover. A concert. The lighted entrance of Wigmore Hall appeared ahead of her, a warm beacon, a safe harbour. The music struck up almost at once, one of Mozart's Haydn quartets, The Hunt. Appropriate, she thought. She had been the hind, he had been the hunter. But now the hind had bounded free. Not quite bounded, perhaps, as she was in a rather poor seat at the back of the hall, squashed between a somewhat shabby young man and an elderly lady. But then one always paid a price for freedom, didn't one? She had been a frequent attender of concerts with her father, and knew the Haydn quartets well, but still felt too flummoxed by her narrow escape to hear the Mozart. Sylvie was a pianist herself, but she avoided attending recitals these days. They reminded her too painfully of a life that might have been. She had been told by her teacher when she was young that she could go on to play at concert level if she took her studies seriously. But then, of course, the bankruptcy, the great fall from grace, had occurred, and the Bechstein had been hauled unceremoniously away and sold to a private buyer. The first thing she had done on moving into Fox Corner was to acquire a Bösendorfer, her wedding present, from Hugh, a great solace for marriage. The dissonant came after the interval. As the almost inaudible opening bars struck up, she found herself weeping soundlessly. The elderly lady passed her a handkerchief, clean and pressed, thank goodness, to staunch her tears. Sylvie mouthed a thank you to her. This mute exchange lifted her spirits a little. At the end of the concert, the woman insisted that she keep the handkerchief. The shabby young man offered to escort her to a cab. How kind strangers were, she thought. She politely declined her would-be escort, a refusal she later regretted, because in her disturbed state she took a wrong turn on Wigmore Street, and then another, and found herself in a far from salubrious area, armed with only a hatpin with which to defend herself. She had once been at home in London, yet now it was a foreign city to her, a dirty, lurid nightmare of a place, and yet she had willingly descended into this circle of hell. She must have been mad. All she wanted to do was to get home, yet here she was wandering the streets like a madwoman. When she eventually found her way back to a gleamingly busy Oxford Street, She cried out in relief. A cab ride later, and she was sitting demurely on a bench on the station platform, as if she were returning from a day of shopping and lunch with friends.
"Goodness," Hugh said. "I thought you must be a burglar. You said you were staying up in town."
"Oh, it was all deathly tedious," Sylvie said. "I decided I would rather come straight back. Mr. Wilson, the station master, gave me a lift in his pony and trap."
Hugh regarded his wife's high complexion, the slightly wild look in her eye of an overused racehorse. Mrs. Shawcross, in contrast, was less of a thoroughbred and more of a good-natured Dobbin, which, in Hugh's opinion, could be preferable sometimes. He kissed Sylvie lightly on the cheek and said,
"I'm sorry that your plans for the evening didn't work out, but it's very nice to have you home."
Sitting in front of her mirror, unpinning her mound of hair, a fresh despair fell on Sylvie. She had been a coward, and now she was chained to this life forever. Hugh came up behind her and rested his hands on her shoulders.
"Beautiful,"
he murmured, running his hands through her hair. She had to suppress the desire to flinch away from him.
"Bed?"
he said, looking hopeful.
"Bed,"
she agreed brightly. But it wasn't just the bird, was it? Teddy thought, as he lay in bed waiting for sleep to find him, the nightly oblivion kept at bay by meandering thought. It wasn't just the one lark that had been silenced by Izzy.
A mouthful!
It was the generations of birds that would have come after it, and now would never be born. All those beautiful songs that would never be sung. Later in his life, he learned the word exponential, and later still the word fractal. But for now it was a flock that grew larger and larger as it disappeared into a future that would never be. Ursula, looking in on him on her way to bed, found him awake and reading Scouting for Boys.
"Can't sleep," she said,
with the offhand sympathy of a fellow insomniac. Teddy's feelings for his sister were almost as straightforward and uncomplicated as those he had for Trixie, who was lying at the foot of the bed, whining softly in her sleep.
"Rabbits, I suppose,"
Ursula said. Ursula sighed. She was 15, and prone to pessimism. Although their mother would have vigorously denied it, this was her character too. His sister perched on his bed and read out loud.
"Be always ready with your armour on, except when you are taking your rest at night."
Perhaps this was his mother's armour of good manners, Teddy thought.
"A metaphor, I expect," Ursula said.
Knights can hardly have been expected to clank around all day long in a suit of armour. I'm always reminded of the Tin Man from The Wizard of Oz when I think of knights. It was a book they were all fond of, but Teddy wished that she hadn't put that image in his mind. The idylls of the king and Mort d'Arthur dissolving into thin air in an instant. An owl hooted, a loud, almost aggressive sound.
"On the roof, by the sound of it," Teddy said.
They listened together for a while.
"Well, night-night,"
Ursula said eventually. She kissed him on the forehead.
"Night-night," he said,
stowing Scouting for Boys beneath his pillow. Despite the owl, which continued to hoot its unholy lullaby, he fell almost immediately into the deep and innocent sleep of the hopeful. The Adventures of Augustus. The Awful Consequences. It began innocently enough, in Augustus's opinion, anyway.
"It always begins innocently," Mr. Swift sighed, although he doubted that Augustus's definition of innocence was the same as that of other people.
"But it wasn't my fault,"
Augustus protested furiously.
"That will be written on your headstone, dear,"
Mrs. Swift said, looking up from the sock she was darning, one of Augustus's, needless to say.
What does he do to them?
She frequently puzzled.
And anyway, how could I have known what would happen?
Augustus said.
There is no action that doesn't bring with it a consequence,
Augustus's father said.
Only the short-sighted don't consider the consequences.
Mr. Swift was a barrister, and in court he spent his day prosecuting the guilty, relishing the to and fro of the courtroom battle. Some of this necessarily spilled over into his own life, which his son thought put his father at an unfair advantage.
Innocent until proven guilty,
Augustus muttered.
You were caught red-handed, Mr. Swift said mildly. Isn't that proof of your guilt?
I wasn't red-handed,
Augustus said indignantly.
And anyway, it was green paint,
Merlud, he added solemnly.
Oh, please, Mrs. Swift murmured. You're giving me a headache.
How can I be giving you a headache?
He asked, hurt by this further accusation.
To give you a headache? I'd have to have a headache in the first place. You can't give something you don't have, and I don't have a headache.
Ergo,
he said grandly, pulling the word from some distant corner of learning,
I cannot have given it to you.
Mrs. Swift's headache was not improved by this barrage of reason. She flapped her hand at her son, as if trying to get rid of a particularly annoying fly, and returned to her darning.
Sometimes, she murmured, I wonder what I did to offend the gods.
Augustus, on the other hand, felt rather pleased with himself. He was putting up a spirited defence. He was an innocent man in the dock, fighting for his rights. His sister, Phyllis, a blue stocking, according to their mother, was always soapboxing about the rights of the common man.
And here I am, Augustus thought. They don't come more common than me. I have rights, you know, he said stoutly. I have been sorely used, he added grandly.
He had heard his brother Lionel, a prig, according to Phyllis, say this over some stupid pash he had on a girl.
Oh, for heaven's sake,
his father said.
You're not Edmund Dantès.
Who?
You never seem to think,
his father said.
Anyone with an ounce of sense could have seen what would happen.
What I was thinking was that I just wanted to see what was on the other side,
Augustus said.
Ah, how many times has that sentence been uttered as a prelude to disaster, I wonder?
Mr. Swift said to no one in particular.
And what was on the other side?
Mrs. Swift asked, unable to stifle her curiosity.
Well,
Augustus said, moving a pear drop from one cheek to the other to give himself time to consider.
Was it by any chance Mrs. Brewster's wig?
Mr. Swift asked in his courtroom voice, the one that implied it already knew the answer.
How was I supposed to know she wore a wig? It could have been any old wig, just a wig, lying around. And how was I to know that Mrs. Brewster was bald? You wear a wig, and you're not bald.
In court, I wear a wig in court,
an exasperated Mr. Swift said.
I don't suppose you have any idea where the dog took the wig?
Mrs. Swift asked her son. Jock, yapping with excitement and a little tainted with the aforesaid green paint, chose that moment to enter the room, and Mrs. Swift...
Oh, ye gods,
Teddy groaned, dropping the book to the floor. Izzy had stolen his life.
How could she?
The paint incident really hadn't been his fault. She had taken his life and twisted it and turned him into a quite different boy, a stupid boy having stupid adventures, with a stupid, stupid, stupid dog, a Westie with a sketchy face and black bead eyes. The book had pictures, cartoony things that made everything so much worse. Augustus himself was a scuffed, badly behaved schoolboy, his cap glued permanently to the back of his head, and a cowlick of hair in his eyes, and a catapult hanging out of his pocket. The book had green card covers and gold lettering, and on the front it said, The Adventures of Augustus, by Delphi Fox, which, apparently, was Izzy's pen name. Inside, it was inscribed,
To my nephew, Teddy. My own darling Augustus.
What rot.
More than anything, it was the Westie that had upset him. It wasn't just the wrong dog, but it reminded him of his awful loss of Trixie, who had died just before Christmas. It had never struck Teddy that she would die before him, so he had suffered as much from disbelief as grief. When he came home from his first term at boarding school, he found her gone, buried alongside Bosun beneath the apple trees.
"We tried to keep her going until you got here, old chap," Hugh said, "but she just couldn't hang on."
Teddy thought he would never get over this bereavement, and perhaps he never did. But a few weeks after the publication of The Adventures of Augustus, Izzy turned up with another gift, a tiny Westie puppy with the name Jock engraved on his expensive collar. Teddy tried very hard not to like him, as it would be not only a betrayal of his love for Trixie, but a sign of his acceptance of the whole horrible fictionalization of his life. It was an impossible task, of course, and the little dog had soon burrowed its way deep into the caverns of his heart. Augustus, however, would plague him one way or another for the rest of his life. Ursula came into the room and picked the book up off the floor and started to read out loud.
"Isn't that Augustus?" Miss Slee whispered in Mr. Swift's ear. Quite a loud whisper, the kind that makes people in surrounding seats turn and look at you with interest.
What had gone into the making of Teddy? Not slugs and snails, it was true, but generation upon generation of Beresfords and Todds, all coming to one singular point in a cold bed, in the chill of an autumn night, when his father had caught hold of the golden rope of his mother's hair and hadn't let go until he had hauled them both to the far shore. They had many euphemisms for the act. As they lay amongst the shipwreck of the marital bed, they each felt slightly befuddled by the unexpected ardour of the other. Hugh cleared his throat and murmured,
"A voyage into the deep, eh?"
Sylvie said nothing, as she felt the seafaring metaphor had been stretched far enough. But the grain had entered the shell, Sylvie's own metaphoric stance, and the pearl that would be Edward Beresford Todd began to grow, until he was revealed into the sunshine that came before the Great War, and lay happily for hours on end in his pram, with nothing but a silver hair dangling from the pram hood for company. His mother was a great lioness padding softly through the house, protecting them all. His father was more of an enigma, disappearing every day to another world, the bank, and then without warning to another even greater and more faraway world, the war. His sisters loved him and swung him and tossed him and covered him in kisses. His brother, already away at school, already trained in the necessary stoicism, sneered at him when he came home in the holidays. His mother held her cheek against his and whispered,
"Out of all of them, you are my favourite."
And he knew it was true, and felt bad for the others. It was a relief, Sylvie thought, finally to know what love was. They were all happy, this much at least he was sure of. Later on he realised it was never as simple as that. Happiness, like life itself, was as fragile as a bird's heartbeat, as fleeting as the bluebells in the wood. But while it lasted, Fox Corner was an Arcadian dream. 1980. The Children of Adam.
"Mummy, I'm hungry."
Viola was too busy surveying the sea to acknowledge this statement. It was the frazzled end of a boiling hot afternoon.
"Day at the beach,"
Dominic had announced enthusiastically that morning. Too enthusiastically, as if going to the seaside had the potential to transform their lives in some transcendental way. Hardly a day passed without him having one great idea or another, most of which seemed to involve drudgery on Viola's part.
"I swear Dominic thinks of six impossible things before breakfast,"
Dorothy laughed admiringly, as if it were a good thing. The world, in Viola's opinion, would be better off without so many ideas. She was 28,
but already jaded. 28 seemed a particularly unsatisfactory age. She was no longer young, and yet no one ever seemed to take her seriously as an adult. People still told her what to do all the time. It was infuriating. Her only power seemed to be over her own children, and even that was limited by endless negotiation. They had borrowed the van from Dorothy for the 5-mile journey, and it broke down, no surprise, a mile from the beach. A passing motorist, an elderly, rather frail-looking man in an old Morris Minor estate, had stopped and done something simple beneath the hood, and, hey presto, the van was fixed. Their rescuer was a local farmer, one of their neighbours, and both he and the Morris Minor were more robust than they appeared. Only the children recognised him, but they gave no sign, already stunned by the heat and the general despair they were feeling at breaking down in Dorothy's van for the third time that month.
"You still need to take it to a garage," the farmer told them. "What I did was just temporary."
Ever helpful, Dominic offered his guru wisdom.
"Man, everything's temporary."
Unmovable mountains and the wheeling stars in the heavens, not to mention the face of God, passed through the farmer's mind, but he was not inclined to disputation. He was bemused by them, the raggle-taggle infants, a touch of the Victorian poor, sitting morosely on the verge with their mother, herself a dishevelled young Madonna, wearing an outfit that seemed to have come out of a dressing-up box. Viola's faux gypsy attire, peasant-style headscarf, DM boots, long velvet skirt, embroidered Indian jacket sewn with little mirrors, had all been put on hastily, without a thought to the fact that they were going to a beach, and that it was already hot, and was only going to get hotter. It had taken so much effort to assemble everything necessary for this hegira: food, drink, towels, swimming costumes, more food, more towels, a change of clothes, buckets, spades, more food, more clothes, fishing nets, a small ball, more drink, a big ball, suntan cream, hats, wet flannels wrung out and put in a plastic bag, a blanket to sit on, that she had simply dragged on the first clothes that she could find.
"Nice day,"
the old man said, tipping his tweed cap to Viola.
"Is it?"
she said. The mechanically inept head of the family, meanwhile, was playing the holy fool, or just the fool, perhaps, prancing around in the road like a jester. He was wearing a tie-dye T-shirt and jeans covered in patches, even where they didn't need patching, something that Viola resented, as she was the one who had done the patching. Stylistically, the whole family was hopelessly out of date. Even the farmer could sense that. He had seen the face of the revolting future, the local town's youth parading in the precinct, ripped and pierced and held together with safety pins, and the juvenile hedonists who had followed in their footsteps, dressed as pirates and outlaws and Civil War royalists. When the farmer was their age, he had dressed like his father and had never thought twice about it.
"We were children of the 60s,
Viola liked to say in later years, as if that in itself made her interesting.
"Flower children."
Although when the 60s were already over, Viola was still wrapped neatly in her grey Quaker school uniform, and the only flowers in her hair were from the occasional childish daisy chain, the flowers plucked from the edge of the school's lacrosse field. She lit a thin roll-up, and gloomily contemplated the bad karma that seemed to be her lot. She drew heavily on the cigarette, and then, in a touching display of maternal responsibility, lifted her chin so that the smoke blew over her children's heads. When she got pregnant the first time, with Sammy, Viola had had no idea what it would involve further down the line. She wasn't sure she'd ever seen a baby, let alone held one, and imagined it would be like getting a cat, or at worst, a puppy. Turned out it was nothing like either. Inertia was her only excuse, really, when a year later she found herself pregnant again, this time with Bertie.
"Our saviour,"
Dominic beamed, when the engine had coughed back into life. He dropped to his knees in front of the farmer, his hands in prayer position above his head, and touched his forehead to the tarmac. Viola wondered if he'd dropped acid. It wasn't always easy to tell, as his existence seemed to be one endless trip, either going up or coming down. It was only when this phase of her life was over that Viola realized that he was a manic depressive. The term bipolar came a little too late for Dominic. He was dead by then.
"Walking in front of a train can do that to you,"
Viola said flippantly to her women's soul drumming group in Leeds, where she studied for a part-time MA in women's studies on the topic of post-counterculture feminism.
"Eh?"
Teddy said. The North, in the 80s, was a hotbed of revolt.
"Grinning nitwit,"
the farmer said to his wife when he got home.
"Posh as well. You would think the rich would know better."
"They don't," the farmer's wife said sagely.
"I felt like bringing a lot of them back here and giving them a plate of ham and eggs and a hot bath."
"They'll have been from the commune," his wife said. "Poor kiddies."
The kiddies had appeared at the farmhouse door a few weeks ago, and at first the farmer's wife thought they were gypsies sent to beg and was going to shoo them away. But then she'd recognized them as the children who lived on the neighboring farm. She'd invited them in and given them milk and cake and let them feed the geese and visit the Red Devon's milking parlor.
"I heard they take drugs and dance naked in the moonlight," the farmer said.
True, although it wasn't as interesting as it sounded. The farmer had failed to spot Bertie before he drove away. She was still sitting on the verge, waving politely at the retreating rear end of the Morris Minor. Bertie wished he had taken her home with him. She had spied through the farmer's five-bar gates and admired his neat fields, the burnished cows, and the fluffy white sheep that looked as if they had just been washed. She had seen the farmer in his battered trilby on his red storybook tractor, trundling up and down those same neat fields. She and Sonny had once wandered unsupervised into the farmyard, and the farmer's wife had given them cake and milk and called them poor mites. She had taken them to see the big red cows being milked, a wonder, and then they had drunk the milk while it was still warm, standing right there in the dairy, and then the farmer's wife had let them feed the big white geese that cackled and honked with excitement, so that Bertie and Sonny had broken into hysterical giggles as the geese milled around them. It had been wonderful until the moment Viola, like a dark cloud, appeared to take them home and started hyperventilating at the sight of the geese. She hated geese for some mysterious reason. Bertie had managed to rescue a feather and had brought it home with her as a talisman. This visit had the quality of a fairy tale for her, and she very much wished that she could find her way back to the magic farmhouse, or be taken there in an old Morris Minor.
"Really hungry, Mummy."
"You're always hungry," Viola said brightly, trying to show by example that it was not always necessary to whine.
"Try saying, 'Mom, I'm hungry. Is there anything to eat, please? What would Mr. Manners think?'"
Mr. Manners, whoever he was, dogged Sonny's life, especially when it came to food. Everything Sonny said came out as a complaint, Viola thought. His name an ironic sobriquet, if ever there was. She was continually trying to get him to take a more cheerful tone.
"Put a sparkle on it,"
she would say, making jazz hands and an exaggerated happy face. When she was at school, at the Mount in York, they had a drama teacher who used to do this. The girls thought it was a ridiculous idea, but now Viola could see the value of sounding chirpy, even when you didn't feel like it. You were more likely to get what you wanted, for one thing. And for another, your mother wouldn't want to strangle you every 5 minutes. Not that she followed her own advice. It was a long time since Viola had put a sparkle on anything, if ever.
"I'm hungry,"
Sonny said more vehemently. He had a way of baring his teeth when he was angry that was horrible. He was a biter, too, when he really got going. Viola still shrank in horror from the memory of the visit they had made to her father last year, trekking north for Sonny's birthday. No, Dominic, of course. He didn't do stuff like family.
"Family?"
her father puzzled.
He doesn't do stuff like family. But he has a family. You, his children. Not to mention his own family.
Dominic was estranged from his parents, something Teddy had a lot of trouble with.
No, I mean traditional stuff, Viola said.
Yes, stuff is a very overused word in Viola's vocabulary. If he hadn't been the father of her children, Viola might have admired Dominic for the way he was so easily able to absolve himself of all obligation simply by asserting his right to self-fulfillment. Sonny had already been working himself up to a tantrum by the time he was helped by his grandfather to blow out the candles on his cake. Viola had made the cake that morning in her father's kitchen, and then pricked out Happy Birthday Sonny in Smarties on the top of it, but with so little skill that her father thought it was Bertie who had done the decoration.
"When are we going to have the cake?"
Sonny whined. He had had to suffer, they had all had to suffer, his way through a stodgy wholemeal macaroni cheese that Viola had made, which was not birthday fare as far as Sonny was concerned. And besides, it was supposed to be his cake.
"Mr. Manners wouldn't like to hear that tone," Viola said. Who was this Mr. Manners, Teddy wondered. He seemed to have usurped parental authority.
Viola cut the cake and placed a slice in front of Sonny, who then, for no reason that Viola could discern, shot forward like a viper and bit her forearm. Without thinking, she slapped his face. The shock catapulted him into silence. A second stretched to infinity as the room held its breath, waiting for the apoplectic shrieking to begin, as it duly did.
"Well, he hurt me,"
Viola said defensively, when she saw the look on her father's face.
"He's 5 years old, for God's sake, Viola.
He has to learn to control himself."
"So do you,"
her father said, picking up Bertie as if she might be in need of protection from further maternal violence.
"Well, what did you expect?"
Viola said sharply to Sonny, masking the shame and remorse she felt at her own deplorable behaviour. The shrieking had turned now into howling, fat tears of anguish and distress smearing Sonny's already chocolate-caked face. She tried to pick him up, but as soon as she put her arms around him and lifted him, his body spasmed into a rigid board that made him impossible to hold on to. When she put him back on the ground, he started to kick her.
"You cannot go around kicking and biting people and not expect consequences," Viola said,
as prim as an old-fashioned nanny, betraying no sign of the messy stew of emotions that occupied her insides. She could feel a demon writhing inside her. The demon often spoke through the pruny lips of prim nanny. Mr. Manners took a timid back seat to prim nanny.
"Yes, I can,"
Sonny roared.
"No, you can't,"
Prim Nanny said calmly,
"because a big policeman will come to the house and take you away to prison and lock you up for years and years."
"Viola," her father said, "for God's sake, get a grip. He's a little boy."
He held out a hand to Sonny and said,
"Come on, let's go and find you a sweetie."
He was always the voice of reason, wasn't he? Or the voice of reason, in Viola's mind, awarding her father the capital letters of the Old Testament. Always nagging at her back, she willfully failed to recognize it as the apprehensive murmur of her own conscience. Viola, left alone at the table, now burst into tears. Why did everything always end up like this? And why was it always her fault? No one ever cared about how she felt, did they? No one made her a birthday cake, for example. Not anymore, anyway. Her father used to, but she hadn't welcomed his handmade offerings, and had lusted after the kind of birthday cakes you saw in the windows of Terry's or Betty's, cake shops that faced off against each other on two sides of St. Helen's Square, like a warring couple. For her 50th birthday, Viola ordered her own cake from Betty's. Terry's having long since left the battlefield. "Happy 50th birthday, Viola," traced delicately in lilac on white, because despite heavy hints, Bertie had failed to understand how significant reaching a half-century was. Viola had outlived her mother by more than 3 years, which was not a competition that she had particularly wanted to win. By then, her mother had receded into an ephemeral past from which she couldn't be recovered. The more Viola forgot her mother, the more she missed her. She told no one about the 50th birthday cake, and ate it all herself. It lasted for weeks, although it was very stale towards the end. Poor Viola. She picked all the orange Smarties off Sunny's cake. They had been made in a factory, all of them, not just the orange ones, on the other side of town. Viola had been on a school tour of Roundtree's factory and seen the colours being tumbled together in what looked like cement mixers made of shining copper. At the end of the visit, they were all given a free box of chocolates. Viola's were never eaten, because when she came home, she threw them at her father. She couldn't remember why now. Because he wasn't her mother, probably. She took the dirty cake plates through to the kitchen and put them in the sink. Through the window, she could see Sunny and Bertie in the garden with their grandfather, who was showing them the daffodils.
"Millions of them,"
Sunny said excitedly when he came running in. Viola gazed at her children, kneeling amongst the flowers, their faces shining with reflected gold. They were laughing and chatting to her father. The sight made her feel incredibly sad. She felt as if she had been on the outside of happiness her whole life.
"Hungry!"
Sunny bellowed at her. Viola, whose eyes remained on the sea, as intent as a lighthouse keeper looking for a wreck, reached behind into her rucksack and fumbled blindly around in its depths before producing the paper bag that contained the sandwiches left over from earlier. Uncompromising things made of dense homemade rye sourdough with a filling of tartex and limp cucumber. Sunny raged at the reappearance of this unattractive feast.
"I don't want that,"
he shouted, throwing the sandwich back at her. His aim was terrible, and the sandwich was snatched up and devoured by a pleasantly surprised Labrador that happened to be passing by.
"I'm sorry,"
Viola said, in that tone of voice which indicated that she was very far from sorry.
"I want something nice,"
Sunny said.
"You never give us anything nice."
"I want never gets," Viola said. Not true of the Labrador, Sunny thought. Prim Nanny had come with them to the beach, apparently. She offered the sandwich to Bertie, who was digging a series of holes. Bertie said,
"Thank you, Mummy,"
because she enjoyed the way her compliance made her mother pleasant to her.
"You're welcome," Viola said.
Sunny growled at this blatant pantomime of manners, performed, he knew, just to make him feel bad. It was like when they played Happy Families, too young for the irony of it, and if you didn't say please and thank you every single time, you lost Master Mouse or Mrs. Robin, even though you had simply forgotten.
"I hate you,"
he muttered to Viola.
Why was she never nice to him?
Nice was Sonny's ideal. One day his utopian vocabulary would be wider, but for now he would settle for nice.
"I hate you,"
he said again, more to himself than his mother.
"La, la, la," Viola said. "I'm afraid I can't hear you."
He took a deep breath and shouted as loud as he could,
"I hate you!"
People turned to look.
"I think there's some people out to sea who didn't hear you," Viola said,
in that pretending to be unruffled way she had that made Sunny want to destroy her. The cold weapon of sarcasm was an evil trick perpetrated by his mother, against which he had no defence. A tempest brewed in his squally heart. He might explode. That would serve his mother right.
"Just give in to her, Sonny," Bertie thought. "You never win, ever."
She carried on digging serenely, one hand manoeuvring her short-handled little spade, the other holding the sandwich, which she had no intention of eating. After she dug placidly for a while, she shifted her bottom along and started another hole, as if she had a plan in mind, although the plan didn't go beyond digging as many holes as possible before the day was done. Bertie had been christened Moon, not christened, named, in a naming ceremony, a ritual devised by Dorothy, and held at night in the woods behind the house with the whole commune present. Viola handed her newborn, peacefully sleeping baby to Dorothy, who raised her up to the moon as if Bertie was an offering, and for one surprising moment, Viola had wondered if her daughter was going to be sacrificed. Bertie held the privilege of being the first baby born in the commune, Dorothy said.
"We give you the future," she said, addressing the moon, who remained noncommittal about the gift.
It began to rain, and Bertie woke up and started to cry.
"Now we must feast,"
Dorothy declared, as they headed indoors. Not on the baby, but on its placenta, fried by Jeanette with onions and parsley. Viola declined her portion. It seemed like cannibalism, not to mention utterly disgusting. And yes, Sun and Moon, those really were their names. Luckily, Bertie had been given her grandmother's name as well.
"Moon Roberta,"
Teddy said, trying to keep his voice expressionless on the telephone when informed of this.
"That's unusual."
"Well, you don't want to be called the same thing as everyone else, do you?" Viola said. "There are enough Sophies and Sarahs in the world. You want something that makes you stand out as different."
Teddy tended to believe the opposite, but kept his counsel. It didn't last long. Sun soon became Sunny, and Bertie avoided being Moony by refusing to answer to any lunar version of her name until most people forgot it was on her birth certificate. Her birth registered very reluctantly by Dominic, who thought it was demanded by a totalitarian bureaucracy, which was the same reason he and Viola weren't married. The only person whom Bertie permitted to remember her parents' lunacy was her grandfather, who sometimes called her Bertie Moon, which Bertie found oddly comforting. She finished another hole, if a hole can ever be said to be finished, and dropped the sandwich in it. Viola gave Sunny the rucksack and said,
"There's a satsuma in there, somewhere."
Her son snarled at the idea of a satsuma.
"Oh, stop belly aching, will you?"
Viola murmured, too intent on the sea to be properly irritated with him.
"Why did you have children?"
Bertie asked later in their lives.
"Was it just the biological imperative to breed?" "That's why everyone has children," Viola said. "They just dress it up as something more sentimental."
Viola wished she had binoculars. The sun, glinting off the water, made it hard to make out anything clearly. There were a lot of people in the sea, and from this distance they all looked pretty much indistinguishable, just shapes bobbing around in the blue like lazy seals. She had terrible short sight, but was too vain to wear her spectacles. Sunny retreated temporarily from the battle and returned to collecting pebbles. He loved pebbles. Rocks, stones, gravel, but sea-smoothed pebbles were best. He couldn't believe what a rich source this beach was. He probably wouldn't even be able to collect all of them.
"Where's Daddy?"
Bertie asked, looking up suddenly from her digging.
"Swimming."
"Where?"
"In the sea, of course."
Near to where she was sitting, Viola noticed a driftwood stick, bone white and brittle, poking up like a skeletal finger post from the sand. She took it, and idly started to sketch symbols in the dry sand, pentagrams and horned moons, and the maligned swastika. She had recently taken up the study of magic, or magic.
"What do you mean, like sawing a woman in half?"
a bewildered Teddy asked.
"Ritual magic. There's a K on the end. Witchcraft. The occult, paganism, the tarot. It's not tricks, it's deep earth stuff. Spells?"
"Sometimes," said with a modest shrug. She had read the tarot last night with Jeanette. The sun, the moon, the fool, one after the other. Her family. The High Priestess, Dorothy, obviously. The Tower, a disaster, a new beginning. The Star, another baby. God forbid, although Star was a nice name. How long had Dominic been gone? He was a good swimmer, but not so good that he could stay out there this long. The sun glared down brightly. For magic, you needed the night, a glittering candle guttering in the dark, not this overexposure. Viola threw away the stick and sighed at the heat. She had so far removed her boots, jacket, and skirt, and headscarf, and was still wearing more clothes than anyone else on the beach. She was down to an antique petticoat and a mismatched long-sleeved bodice, fussy ribbon things trimmed with broderie anglaise, which she had found in a second-hand shop. Unknown to Viola, the petticoat had originally belonged to a shop girl who had died of consumption, and who would have been shocked and not at all pleased to see her undergarments on display on a beach in Devon. Viola gave up on her sea-watch and rolled another cigarette. She loathed the seaside. Every summer when she was small, when they were still a proper family, they had gone to cold, wet beaches for their obligatory summer holiday. Purgatory, as far as Viola was concerned. It must have been her father's idea. Her mother had probably wanted to go somewhere warm and sunny, where they could enjoy themselves. But her father had the kind of Puritan streak that would consider a beach by the North Sea to be good for a child. She sucked furiously on the roll-up. Her childhood had been warped by his reasonableness. She lay back on the sand and stared at the cloudless sky while contemplating the unbearable tedium of her life. This in itself soon grew tedious, and she sat up and pulled a book out of the bottomless rucksack. She had never been without a book for as long as she could remember. An only child never is. Literature had fueled her childhood fantasies and convinced her that one day she would be the heroine of her own narrative. Throughout her teens she inhabited the 19th century, roaming the moors with the Brontes, feeling vexed at the constraint of Austen's drawing rooms. Dickens was her rather sentimental friend, George Eliot her more rigorous one. Viola was currently rereading an old copy of Cranford. Mrs. Gaskell did not feel at home in Adam's Acre, where the reading matter ran from Hunter S. Thompson to Patanjali's sutras with not much in between. Viola sat on the hot sand, twirling a lock of hair around her finger, a long-time habit that annoyed everyone except Viola herself, and wondered why she hadn't worked harder at university instead of being led astray by Dominic and lying around smoking dope. She could have been a lecturer herself by now, a professor even. The sun flared on Mrs. Gaskell's bright white pages, and Viola suspected that she was about to get a headache. Her mother had basically died of a headache. This short entente was broken by Sonny reversing his decision about the Satsuma, but instead of eating it, he threw it at Bertie, an action which led to a violent shouting match between the two of them, halted only by the diversionary tactic of giving them money to go and buy ice creams. There was a van up on the promenade, and Viola watched them tramping along towards it until she couldn't make them out any longer. She closed her eyes. 5 minutes' peace. Was that too much to ask? Viola was in her first year at a brutalist concrete and glass university when she met Dominic Villars, an art school dropout still hanging around the fringes of academic life. He was the scion, Viola had to look the word up, of a semi-aristocratic family. His legendary drug use, his public school background, and the wealthy parents he had rejected in order to live in painterly squalor all gave him a certain cachet. Viola, desperate to rebel and throw off her provincial middle-class chains, by proxy if nothing else, was attracted to his infamy. Dominic was also very good-looking, and she was flattered when, after circling around her for several weeks, he finally pounced, albeit lethargically, if one compounds lethargically, and said,
"Come back to mine."
No etchings on offer in his squalid flat, but plenty of large canvases that looked as if they'd had primary colours simply thrown at them.
"You can tell," he said,
impressed that she understood his technique. Viola, Philistine that she was, couldn't help thinking,
"But I could do that."
"Do they sell?" she asked innocently, and received a patient lecture about
subverting the exchange relationship between producer and consumer.
"You mean by giving stuff away?"
she said, baffled. As an only child, she never gave anything away.
"Hey," he said laconically,
when he turned round from appreciating his own art and saw her lying naked on his grubby sheets. He lived off benefits, which was cool, he said, because it meant the Stalinist state was paying for him to produce art.
"The taxpayer, you mean?" Teddy said.
Viola had delayed taking her bow, Teddy's word he had searched for something innocuous, home for a long time, afraid that her father's quietly conservative views and the orderly restraint of his house in York would reflect badly on her. She thought with distaste of her father's garden, neat rows of salvia, alyssum and lobelia in red, white and blue. Why not just plant a Union Jack?
"It's not patriotism," he protested. "I happen to think that those colours go nicely together."
"Gardens," Dominic said.
Teddy waited for the rest of the sentence, but it never came.
"You like them?" he prompted.
"Yeah, they're great. My people have a maze."
"A maze?"
"Yeah."
Dominic, to his credit, prided himself on his egalitarianism.
"Dukes or dustmen," he said. "It's all the same to me."
Although Viola suspected that he knew more dukes than dustmen. His people, as he referred to them, lived in the depths of Norfolk, and were of the hunting, shooting, fishing tribe, vaguely related to royalty,
on the wrong side of the blanket.
Viola had never met them, the estrangement still firmly in place even after the birth of Sonny and Bertie.
"They don't want to meet their grandchildren," Teddy said. "That's very sad."
Viola had been relieved. She suspected that she would never measure up in the eyes of his people. Why exactly was he alienated from them, Teddy asked.
"Oh, you know, the usual. Drugs, art, politics. They think I'm a waster. I think they're fascists."
"Well, he's a good-looking chap at any rate," Teddy said,
searching for something complimentary to say as he and Viola washed the pots together after a ham salad and an apple crumble that he'd made that morning. Teddy was handy in the kitchen,
even though I say so myself.
Dominic was having 40 winks in the living room.
"Tired, is he?"
Teddy said. Viola had never seen her father asleep, not even a catnap or a deckchair snooze. When Dominic woke up, Teddy, unable to think of anything else, somehow he couldn't imagine Dominic playing board games, got out the photo albums in which his daughter's awkwardness was displayed at various ages and in varying degrees. Viola was never good in front of a camera.
"She's much prettier in real life," Teddy said.
"Yeah, very sexy,"
Dominic said, leered even. Viola preened a little. Her father, she noticed, grimaced at Dominic's remark and all that it implied. "Get used to it," she thought. "I'm a grown woman now."
"I screw, therefore I am,"
she had written in the front of her Penguin Classics copy of Descartes' Discourse on Method, pleased with her iconoclasm. She was the next in a long line of girlfriends, and she was never sure why Dominic had stopped at her. Not stopped, merely paused, it turned out.
"But you're the one I always come home to," he said.
Like a dog, she thought, but not without satisfaction. They were both, essentially, very lazy people, and it was easier to stay together than it was to pull themselves apart. Viola managed to struggle her way through her finals, and came away with an undistinguished third, a mashed-up degree of philosophy, American studies, and English literature.